Why it's so hard to admit when we're wrong. Have you ever had someone honk at you after you cut them off in traffic? Psychological research tells us that your response to that honk will most likely be, "Oh, I had the right of way. He was wrong." And not, "Oh gosh, I shouldn't have done that. I made a mistake." That scenario is just a little example of something psychologists call cognitive dissonance. And cognitive dissonance is one of the reasons human beings have such a hard time admitting when they are wrong. I'm Jennifer Rooks. On today's program, we will talk about this human tendency and how it impacts the world and our lives, from politics to personal relationships. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. We all make mistakes, but whether we admit to making mistakes is another question, and that is the topic for today's program. Why is it so difficult, at least for many of us, to admit when we are wrong? And how does that affect society at large? Joining me in our studio, Julie Landjua Peterson, who is an associate professor of psychology and the Women's and Gender Studies Program Director at the University of New England. And Jordan LaBeouf is an associate professor of psychology and honors at the University of Maine. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you find it difficult to admit when you're wrong? Do you have a friend, maybe a family member, who can never seem to acknowledge having made a mistake? You can share your or their story at 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you both for being here so much. And what an interesting topic. So, Julie, why is it? Why don't I even back up a little bit? I've read that we have a hard time admitting we're wrong. Is it true? Is it indeed a researched and studied human tendency to not like to admit we're wrong?
You know, Jennifer, it is actually true, and it's fairly normal. And in many ways, it can be good for our mental health, good for our feelings of self-worth, until, of course, people start using it too frequently or in ways that hurt themselves and others.
Is there some evolutionary reason, Jordan? Is there some theory that we can't admit we're wrong because back we were hunter-gatherers, this would have happened?
Well, I think there are some sort of social evolutionary reasons for this. I mean, it's really important for us personally to be able to perceive the world accurately and consistently, because if we don't, then the world is kind of a scary, unpredictable place. So any reason to believe that we might not be consistent or accurate might sort of throw us off and make us wary of being able to predict what's going to happen in the future.
So I see a problem in what you just said, though, that we need to be able to see the world consistently and accurately, and yet those two are often in conflict. I mean, what is accurate may change.
Right. I think you're absolutely right. What we need to do is believe that we see the world consistently and accurately, right? That self-concept of being consistent, of being right, of being accurate is really important. And when that gets threatened, when people are faced with being wrong about something, especially something that's important to their identity, they tend to feel really threatened by that and try to defend it or try to interpret the facts in a way that's consistent with what they already believe.
All right. So I know that there's some psychological terms here that are used in these discussions. I'm going to have you all explain them. Most of us have heard about this concept of cognitive dissonance. Julie, explain what it is, an example of how it might manifest itself in a small way and maybe in a much larger way.
Yeah, sure. So cognitive dissonance is a scenario in which an individual holds two discrepant either attitudes or beliefs or values. So the classic example tends to be with smoking. So there's the behavior of smoking, which is probably inconsistent with people's knowledge of or beliefs about the way that smoking affects health. And yet, even though people know that smoking is bad for them, they continue often to smoke anyway. In order to reduce the state of tension known as cognitive dissonance between smoking and the knowledge that smoking's bad for you, you have to either change the behavior, quit smoking, or you have to change the dissonant cognition. So you have to maybe think, well, I don't smoke that much, or, you know, I had a grandma who smoked her whole life and she lived till she was 93. So, and in that way, we reduce that sort of awkward or painful sense of tension by either changing the behavior or changing the cognition.
So this is what people who do not research or are not psychologists might refer to as rationalization. When
yeah.
we rationalize
yes,
something
absolutely.
That in our gut we know.
Yeah, and I think sometimes it's a little less conscious than that.
Mm.
So I think sometimes we might find ourselves making excuses. So, you know, on the one hand, we like to believe that we're like these decent, moral, good people. But the reality is that we don't always act in decent, moral ways. And so we get this conflict between who we think we are and how we've actually behaved. And in order to reconcile that difference and that feeling it elicits in us, that feeling of tension and arousal, we have to either admit we're wrong and change our behavior, or we have to spin the behavior in a way that aligns with our views of ourselves as moral, decent people.
Okay, so I know another one of them is confirmation bias. Jordan, I'm going to have you explain that one to us.
Sure. So confirmation bias is the tendency for us to see what we already believe in the evidence that's in front of us. So if, for example, I am looking for information about climate change, and I already have an opinion about climate change, I am likely to search for information that confirms my pre-existing opinions, even, and again, Julie already mentioned this, but non-consciously. Even if I intentionally try to find neutral sources, I'm still more likely to spend more energy and more attention, and more of my ideas will mesh with the pieces that are more consistent. I'm also going to interpret that information in ways that is more consistent with my existing idea. So to continue that example of climate change, when I read information about how the Arctic is super hot right now, I might interpret that information in light of, oh, short-term climate patterns, and it's just a bubble, it's going to change if I don't believe in climate change, but I might interpret it as evidence that there is global human-caused climate change if I do believe in it. So confirmation bias is that tendency to see what we already think in new information that's presented to us.
And then discount what we don't already think.
Exactly. That's super important too, because it's not just that we hear that information and discount it and get rid of it. We often don't even notice that information that's disconfirming because we have these sort of implicit under non-conscious processes that encourage us to sort of ignore that piece and focus our attention on the stuff that's confirming.
So what we're talking about is not only why it's so difficult to admit that we're wrong, but why it's so difficult even to acknowledge or know when we're wrong.
Yeah, I think that's super important. When I was thinking about our topic today, I was thinking about how few people really recognize they're wrong and refuse to admit it. Instead, it's that people don't recognize their opinions and beliefs are wrong. In fact, there's a whole line of psychological research on belief perseverance that shows that even when people are shown factual, clear, indisputable evidence that they're wrong, they still hold on to those opinions for a little while thereafter. They're weaker, but they still have those opinions.
All right. And so one more, Julie, suffering and self-justification.
Mm. All right. So this is a phenomenon in which people prefer things for which they have suffered. A classic example is a really terrible initiation process. Like you can think of a fraternity or maybe a sorority. Like I think fraternity is more stereotypically this sort of hazing process. What they find is that when people have suffered for some sort of success, whether it be small or large, for group membership, whatever it might be, the more that they suffer, the more value they place on either that group membership or that success later. And the idea is that, again, if we are to see ourselves as, you know, sort of rational people, then, you know, most of the time we would think, why would I have suffered for this? It's not really worth it. Nobody you know, at least according to behaviorists, right, that when we're punished or we have some sort of pain or negative effect, we should like something less. But humans are a little bit different than animals. And part of what happens is that when humans suffer for something, they tend to actually place more value on it, like as a reason to justify why they went through this arduous process or why they went through this initiation process. They've come to actually like it more than those things for which they have not suffered.
Oh, my goodness. This is also interesting. If you'd like to join the conversation on why we can't admit we make mistakes, join us at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Send an email to talk@mainpublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Jordan, in the information I've been reading this morning, a lot of authors refer to sort of the beginning of this thinking as an experiment that took place in 1954. And I'd like you to tell our viewers about it or listeners about this, because it's really fun and it's very instructive.
Yeah, sure. So Leon Festinger is sort of the father of research on cognitive dissonance, this idea that when we hold an attitude that is different from our behaviors, that we feel uncomfortable. And so he did a series of studies that sort of culminated in one called When Prophecy Fails. And it's this really interesting story about following a cult that had predicted the end of the world. Long story short, the world did not end when they predicted
that. Well, we are sitting here, yes.
And as a result, we might expect all of those people who had predicted loudly the end of the world to come out and say, oh, geez, we were wrong. I guess we should go to our lives in a different way. But of course, instead, people persisted in their beliefs, and they explained the fact that the world end as evidence for their belief. Some people said, oh, we may have gotten the date wrong and they planned for another future event. But others suggested that their belief was so fervent that that is why the end of the world didn't happen in the first place. And so they really engaged in some of this confirmation bias. They took the evidence in that the world did not end, and they reinterpreted that evidence, instead of as disconfirming their belief in the end of the world, as confirming their overall identity and faith. And so whether it's a small thing like one person, this isn't a small thing, but whether one person is quitting smoking, or whether it's a whole ritualistic belief where people are expecting the end of the world, these same simple psychological processes of wanting to be accurate and consistent are underlying all of that.
I'm going to read a quote, and this is apparently from Catherine Schultz in a book that was written in 2010, Being Wrong, Adventures in the Margin of Error. She writes, a whole lot of us go through life assuming that we are basically right, basically all the time, about basically everything, about our political and intellectual convictions, our religious and moral beliefs, our assessment of other people, our memories, our grasp of facts. As absurd as it sounds when we stop to think about it, our steady state seems to be one of unconsciously assuming that we are very close to omniscient. Julie, you're nodding. This is right.
Yeah. So I think, I know we're throwing around a lot of terms here today, but I think this is really akin to another phenomenon called naive realism. And this is the idea that people believe that they are rational or see the world in rational ways. And if someone else doesn't see the world that way, then that person is irrational. And again, that's naive, right? Because many of us come to the table with lots of different life experiences and perspectives, and it is not surprising that we see the world differently. But the idea is that we hold our perspective of the world as sort of higher status, as more correct or more right. And as a result, it can be really difficult to get people to acknowledge that their view of the world is not necessarily the correct view of the world.
And this, of course, leads us to politics today and where we are. You know, when you do a program, when you're talking to political scientists, they will say X percentage of people will always vote this way, X percentage of people will always vote the other way. Is this sort of one of the manifestations of everything we're talking to about up to this point, Jordan?
Yeah, I think so. I mentioned earlier that we tend to hold on to our beliefs and opinions, particularly when they're an important part of our identity. And what I mean by that is how we think about ourselves and how other people think about us. So if I identify strongly as a conservative or a liberal, then those opinions that are a part of that social identity become really important. And if I have to admit that one of those things is wrong, or that somebody sort of on my team has made a mistake, that brings the whole identity into question. And might make me question a sort of view of the world as opposed to one individual fact. It all becomes sort of tied together in that social identity, making it a lot harder for people to admit they're wrong on any one tiny thing.
I think we also have, and I'm not sure if this is new to politics, but is certainly embedded in our political structure today, is this idea that the Democratic Party has an entire platform and the Republican Party has an entire platform that encompasses a variety of stances on a variety of issues. And to be discrepant with any one of those issues then no longer makes you either a Democrat or no longer makes you either a Republican. It's almost like you have to embrace all of the stances of a party in order to identify with that party. And so to go back to what Jordan was saying then, is that if you strongly identify as a Republican or you strongly identify as a Democrat, then to no longer believe in or endorse one aspect of that platform really threatens that part of your own identity.
Yeah. Interesting. Jordan, you just finished a paper on intellectual humility. What is that and how does it relate to what we're talking about here?
Sure. So I've been working on this project with Elizabeth Kumre Mamnakuso, who's at Pepperdine University. And she and others have really been interested in this quality of intellectual humility because of this phenomenon that we're discussing. It's so common that we all assume that we're right all the time, that encountering somebody who acknowledges the limits of their intellectual ability is somewhat rare. And so we sort of went about trying to understand what that is and how we can create it and how it's related to education. So what we really find is that some people are able to distance their ego from their intellect. Most people, those two things are pretty tightly tied together. How smart I am means that that's a part of my identity, but some people are able to separate those sorts of things. And so when we do that, people are more able to be open to new ideas and change their opinions more often.
So how does one do that?
Isn't that a great question? So one of the things that we know works well is creating an educational environment that celebrates failure and learning as a part of the process. And this doesn't have to be in school. It can be in corporate cultures or social groups that look at somebody making a mistake instead of as something to ridicule or to point out, as something to celebrate as the first step on a learning process. That kind of learning culture is how the literature talks about this, is really powerful, but also really difficult to create, especially in an American culture that really promises winning is great and that's all we should focus on, right? So it's a difficult thing to create, but something that we have seen some progress with.
On that note, we have to take our first quick break. We're talking about the idea that we have a hard time admitting we're wrong, human beings. If you'd like to join in, our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Maine Masonic Charitable Foundation, supporting Maine Public Radio's efforts to provide knowledge, wisdom, and entertainment to the people of Maine. And New England Rehabilitation Hospital of Portland, helping patients and their families after illness or injury. Learn more at nerhp.org.
Senate Democrats are demanding Judge Brett Kavanaugh turn over thousands of pages of documents before his nomination moves forward.
The Senate and the American people deserve to know where Judge Kavanaugh stands on a host of issues. After all, Supreme Court is a lifetime appointment with enormous power.
I'm Audie Cornish, Senate Democrats and the fight for the Supreme Court, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
From 4 to 6:30 each weekday evening here on Maine Public Radio.
When you wake up each morning, chances are good your eyes are opened in another way, too, by listening to Morning Edition. Hi, this is Erwin Gratz. This public radio service helps you become aware, to understand, to learn, basically to grow as you go about your morning. Morning Edition feeds your curiosity and need to know and understand what's going on. And public radio depends on you to stay strong and grow as well. It's an essential service, seemingly becoming more important each and every day, that runs on listeners' support. So let's grow together. If you haven't already, please support this station financially right now at mainepublic.org or on Super Thursday, our upcoming one-day campaign on August 2nd. And thanks.
Super Thursday coming up August 2nd, but you can contribute right now at mainpublic.org or by calling 1-800-866-1475.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, why we have trouble admitting we are wrong. Joining me in the studio, Julie Landjua-Peterson. She's an associate professor of psychology at the University of New England. And Jordan LaBeouf is an associate professor of psychology at UMaine. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling or post to our Facebook page. I'm going to start with a Facebook comment. This is from Jason. He writes, "Our leaders and politicians are frankly terrible examples for us. I cannot think of anyone taking accountability for anything that has happened in most of my 59-year lifetime. No one was at fault or held accountable for anything. War, financial collapse, and now a president that lies every day. Every single day, the leader of this country lies, demonstrably and with intent. It's disgusting that this country is sunk so low as to tolerate this."
Wow. I mean, I think it on the one hand speaks to an understanding that things today maybe aren't so different than before, that in politics it is sort of the status quo to refrain from taking responsibility for things that go wrong. I think it's embedded in our political system and also in some of our corporate system as well, anywhere where there's sort of a hierarchy, that people who rise to the top are people who are able to maintain the perception of not necessarily perfection, but strength and power. And unfortunately, I think power sometimes gets conflated with always being right. And so we tend to see powerful people as people who cannot be taken down even by their own errors. And I think that's in some ways what's happening in politics today.
Well, I'm thinking about, an example that's going on right now is Sean Spicer in the news admitting that maybe he was wrong when he said that the president's inaugural numbers were inflated. But then also I'm thinking back to the 1990s when McNamara came out and expressed some doubt and remorse about the Vietnam War. And in both cases, especially in the 90s, but today as well, people are angry.
Right.
So there doesn't seem to be any motivation to admit that you're wrong.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that's important. We talked a little bit ago about the culture that we build surrounding being right. And I think that we're not exactly reinforcing people when they admit that they're wrong or when they admit that they make mistakes. I think we have had leaders who have been more likely to say these things that either that I have done or more likely that we have done as a nation have been wrong. And in those situations, those people are often criticized, even for things that we all collectively agree are wrong, like America's past with slavery or those sorts of things. Even criticizing our past behavior in that way it sometimes is taken under fire because we do have a both political and social culture that really values accuracy and being right all the time.
We'll go to Charlotte calling from Portland. Hi, Charlotte. Go ahead.
Hi there. I just have two short comments. And the first is, I wonder how capable people are of learning if they are unable to admit that they were wrong. And second, I wanted to remind listeners of the Trump confessi tweet and how he insisted that he knew what that word meant.
So actually, Jordan and I earlier were talking a little bit about, when do people actually admit they're wrong? Like, what are the scenarios that elicit that sort of critical eye towards the self and truth? And one of the things we talked about is that you can learn. One way to learn is to know what cognitive dissonance is, know why you might be rationalizing behaviors that were wrong or hurtful or untruthful in some way, and then try and correct for it. I think that that is easier said than done. We know that people more easily notice these things in other people's behavior than their own behavior. But I do think knowledge is power in this sense, and that the more you are aware, the more you can learn to change this. And we also know that changing it is good for the self as well. So, people don't necessarily grow or adapt unless they can take a critical eye towards themselves and admit when they have failed or done something wrong, because we can learn from our mistakes. And ultimately, that is probably a better route to go, and one that is more sustainable for our feelings of self-worth than the latter.
Charlotte, thanks for your call. We'll go to Gabriel, who's calling from Orono. Hi, Gabriel. Go ahead.
Hi. I guess it's sort of along the same lines of what you guys are talking about as far as ways in which you can sort of take a critical eye to your own behavior. Specifically in my marriage, having my partner be able to admit sort of when she's wrong helps me to look at in conflict where I might not, like, you know, maybe digging my heels in, because I'm a pretty stubborn person. But I just think that I'm curious as to what your thoughts are on sort of like that sort of communication.
Sure. When you first admit you're wrong and you apologize, you lose some power, don't you?
Yeah, you know, this is really similar to what we call the risk regulation model. We're really regulating our risk of rejection in our close relationships, particularly our romantic relationships. But the admission of a fault actually elicits admissions of fault from your partner as well. And so I'm not surprised it's sort of contagious that your partner admits that she's done something wrong or that she's hurt your feeling. And what that does is soften you. It doesn't put you on the defensive. Rather, instead, it allows you to admit that you've done some things wrong too, because ultimately, you know, it does take two to tango. And most of the time we are both at fault for a disagreement. So I think your experience and real life really matches quite well onto the close relationships literature.
Yeah, and I think, Gabriel, I like that you mentioned your partner, because it also brings up another issue in admitting we're wrong, which is being able to take on the perspective of other people. When we're in a close romantic relationship, usually, ideally, we're better able to take on that perspective and see the world from that person's eyes. It's still hard, but it's something that we're a little bit better able to do. And so that's a way that we can start taking that critical eye to ourselves, is trying to think about how my behavior is seen through the eyes of my partner, who may not know everything that's going on in my head, right? And may see that a little less biased than I do.
Gabriel, thanks for your call. A Facebook post from Annie. My dad is one of the authors of When Prophecy Fails. Every day I think of what they found and wonder how to deal with people who believe things that I know to be untrue.
I think that's a great point. And Annie, I would love to meet you and your dad, I'm sure. But I think I try to think about that all the time. I spend a lot of time hearing headlines and then trying actively to think about how would this headline sound if I had the completely opposite political opinion than I do have. That's one I don't know if that actually works. I don't have any data about it. But that's one practice that I try to undertake because of my understanding of this stuff, to try to think about how would this be received if I had an opposite worldview? Would I accept this as uncritically as I am if I thought about this differently?
Does having your expertise for both of you leave you, I don't want to use maybe the word unmoored sometimes when you're taking in information, and do you think about it differently than the rest of us do you think?
I think probably a little bit. I think we're not totally immune to this, though. Mm-hmm. We're also human. Oh. And I think think of this as like a default style of processing. You know, when we're cognitively loaded, when we're tired, when we're taxed, we might make the same errors that someone else who doesn't have this knowledge would make. So I think it can benefit if you have the time, resources, and ability to use that knowledge to kind of overstep those less controlled processes.
Yeah, and I love the word you use, unmoored, because I think it does lead me to find places where I just sort of go, well, because of my biases, I don't know that I will ever actually know the truth of that thing.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
I just won't know. And that's discomforting, and I don't like it, but I have to just accept that because I can't know.
We'll go to Dale calling from Portland. Hi, Dale. Go ahead.
Hi. I would love this topic, and I think that failure is a very important part of learning and leads to some fabulous results when you embrace it. I'm a physics professor, and I tell all my students when they're learning physics that it's an education in humility, because they will be humbled. It doesn't matter who they are. They will be wrong. And at the end, find that they become self-reflective individuals. And it's just a very valuable tool to fail.
Yeah, Dale, I agree. I was just talking with Julie before the show and told her my lab motto, my research lab, is stolen from the Mythbusters. And it's failure is always an option. And I think we have to keep that in the forefront of our minds. If a quarter of my hypotheses are correct, I am doing great. So failure is just a part of the process. And when I say that in my classrooms, when I tell students at the beginning of a class, failure is always an option, they begin by rejecting that premise. They do not like that idea. Because I think we raise students in particular to be achieving, and that an A is the only option. And I think that that realizing that failure is the appropriate pathway to success and to an A is something that's a little foreign to our educational culture and to our students, and something that's really helpful.
Is that worldwide, or is that American culture?
You know, that's a good question. I don't have any good data for
it. Yeah, I don't have any good data for it either. I would imagine it is more westernized or industrialized. And I would imagine in collectivist cultures, it is less so that way. The process is probably more important.
Yeah. Here's an analogy for you. It's like any batting average more than 300 in Major League Baseball is pretty good, right?
Right. Exactly. You're failing a lot of the time, right?
Thanks, Dale, for your call. Here's an email from Jackie. My partner and I have a relationship-saving trick. When one of us realizes or comes to find out that what we thought or said was wrong, we say to our partner, "You were right all along." We don't say, "I was wrong." Instead, "You were right all along, Janie Jones," is affirming rather than demoralizing.
Oh, I love that tactic. You know, I think that within the realm of close relationships, most of us have to find ways to admit we're wrong, but also to draw us closer. You know, conflict is a natural part of all close relationships, and one that is also very healthy. And it sounds like she and her partner have found a really great way to resolve their disagreements.
We'll go to Cassie, who's calling from Stonington. Hi, Cassie. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. I'm fascinated that we've gotten this far in the discussion about difficulty in admitting that we are wrong without the word shame coming to the forefront, because for me, that's the first thing that does jump up, because if being wrong triggers shame, shame, of course, tells you that, you know, being wrong means that you, your very self, are just wrong, you know, as an entity in this world. So it's so threatening, you know, to admit, you know, and kind of agree with the fact that you are so terribly and intrinsically wrong. But I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon, and we just laugh a lot because we say our best thinking got us here in our struggles with alcoholism, trying, you know, to correct somebody who we think is wrong. And in this program, discovering again and again how wrong we've been in our approach. And so the program invites us to admit to our higher power, to ourselves and another human being, that we're wrong, and when we're wrong, to promptly admit it. And for me, the only way this became possible was by detaching being wrong from a sense of shame and just normalizing it to the point where it was simply, I'm a human being, I made a mistake, I'm sorry. So
one of the things about shame is that it's really derived from a perception that you are either not meeting up to your own expectations or the expectations of people you care about. And I think it's really important to divorce shame from failure, in part because if our failure is now part of a new set of expectations, right, that we are allowed to be wrong sometimes, and that's the expectation I have of myself, then I will no longer feel that shame. And I think that's really important.
Cassie, thanks so much for your call. An email from Jolene. Here's the importance of admitting you're wrong when you make a mistake. Of course, nobody is always 100% right, and nobody would ever believe such a thing about you. If you admit you're wrong when you are, then people may be more likely to believe you when you say you're 100% sure about something. It makes it more probable that others will believe when you say you are 100% sure. Am I right? There's an interesting question. Interesting PhD project, right?
Yeah. Well, of course you're right, because we're all always right, remember? I think the honest broker piece of this is really important. We've talked a little bit about social standing and the need to be right. But this is a really important part of it, because if now other people don't perceive me as somebody who is an accurate predictor or who is likely to be wrong, then I'm going to lose social standing. And that's something that's really important to all of us, right? And so I think if people are trusted, they can increase in trust. We can trust people more who are able to admit that they're wrong. Yeah, I think that's great.
I think in some ways, too, it might be different in different areas. So I think that's really applicable for close relationships. You know, if you learn again and again and again and again that your partner is never willing to admit they're wrong, that's really, over time, will degrade a relationship.
Right.
I think in politics, it's been a little bit more difficult for that process to occur, because we really value politicians that don't show sign of weaknesses. Mm. And if we associate admitting you're wrong with weakness, then I think it's a little bit more difficult to see that pattern there.
We have to take another quick break, but first, a word about tomorrow's program. We are going to be talking about public art, specifically murals in Maine. If there is a mural in your community, send us a photo to talk@mainepublic.org. In the meantime, we're talking about the idea that we cannot admit we're wrong. If you would like to join the conversation, the phone number 1-800-399-3566. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Coastal Maine Botanical Gardens, celebrating the bounty of butterflies with the opening of their new native butterfly and moth house, open daily until October 31st. And Maine Seacoast Mission, empowering youth, promoting health, and supporting Downeast and Island communities since 1905. More at seacoastmission.org.
Next time with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, Prokofiev battled Soviet bureaucrats, demanding ballerinas, and other unexpected obstacles to get his adaptation of Romeo and Juliet staged. It's survived as one of the most popular full-length ballets ever written. Michael Tilson Thomas conducts a suite from the Shakespeare adaptation, next time with a CSO.
Tonight at 8 o'clock on Maine Public Classical. And coming up shortly at 2 o'clock, it's World Affairs, a discussion about cyber warfare and weapons from state and non-state sponsors and how to deal with this new reality. After Maine Calling at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, why we humans have trouble admitting we're wrong. My guests are two psychology professors. Julie Langeua Peterson is with the University of New England, and Jordan LaBeouf is with the University of Maine. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Julie, are there things we can do to help other people admit that they're wrong?
Yeah, so there is this interesting little study from Karina Schumann in 2014 where she has participants self-affirm in another area. So they think about things that they value and write about why those values are important to them. And then later on, they are asked to admit something they're wrong about. And what she finds is that people are less defensive after they've self-affirmed in an unrelated area. So, you know, if we apply this to everyday life, it is absolutely possible that if you can affirm your friend or your partner in some other unrelated area to what you think they're wrong in, that they may be more willing to admit they're wrong after all.
So, Julie, if I'm going into a difficult meeting or negotiation, I could myself and ask the other people that I'm going in to talk with to spend some time ahead of time writing about the things that we think are important,
yeah,
and the things that we do well, really affirming ourselves. And then when we get into that meeting, maybe we'll be more likely to acknowledge where we're wrong and be more cooperative.
And quite frankly, if you know what people value already, you could compliment them
right,
on what they value.
Right.
And as a result, they might be better negotiators. So negotiate in your way.
Right.
I want both of you on my team. We're going to go to Zizi calling from Norway. Hi, Zizi. Go ahead.
Hi there. I love this conversation, especially because I just finished reading The Untethered Soul by Michael A. Singer. And it goes back to what Jordan was saying at the beginning of the conversation about how do we actually make this happen. And I feel like Singer has really spelled out from A to Z for the American mind how to really get a good step back from your ego and be able to practice that muscle, like really learn how to do that, take a deep breath, step back, and be separated from your ego so that that's not what's speaking, but more your essence is what's speaking. And I think that just what Julia just said about values, it's sort of like, what do we value? What is my essence? And that speaks more than my ego. If I can train it to do that, especially when I'm tired or, you know, upset or something like that. So thank you so much.
Yeah, I like that piece about training and what Julie was talking about earlier and recognizing cognitive dissonance. I think one of the things I try to do is to recognize the physical feeling of being uncomfortable about some opinion that's being threatened. I was just reading an article in the Chronicle of Higher Education the other day that had this great phrase that I'm going to steal, but was, your body can't tell the difference between an idea threat and a bear. Our physical reactions, our sympathetic nervous system reacts the same way to all different kinds of threats. Our pulse races, we feel threatened. We start into that fight or flight mode. And it might come out as a Facebook comment in one instance and running away in a forest in another instance, but the feeling is the same. And if we can recognize that feeling, we can then maybe take a step back from that ego and say, okay, why am I having this reaction? What identity is being threatened here? And how might I think about this in a way, if I weren't feeling threatened, how would I think about this?
That explains so much for political discourse
exactly.
today.
Exactly. Right. We don't know the difference between a Facebook troll and a bear. And so we have this very physiological reaction to those sorts of things that prevent us from thinking critically.
Zizi, thanks for your call. We're going to go to Debbie in Stockton Spring. Hi, Debbie. Go ahead.
Hi. I was listening to the show about being right and wrong. Is this the right show?
Yes, yes. Go ahead. What's your question?
Okay. My entire life, I have thought I am wrong. That I will be wrong. Whatever I do, it's going to be wrong. And I wonder, why am I like this if everybody else is different?
Oh, I think we lost her. And my notes here say that Debbie was
one. Yeah.
Okay, go ahead. And you're wondering if there's a gender difference, right?
Yes, this is a gender difference. The females tend to believe they are wrong. Because when we get in car accidents, women jump out of the car and say, I'm so sorry. Whereas men jump out and scream at one another.
Well, you know, so there is not a gender difference in cognitive dissonance, right? So we all experience cognitive dissonance at relatively the same rate. I think there is a difference in the degree to which men and women apologize for their actions. I think women are taught fairly early in life that they are responsible for other people's emotions and managing other people's emotions. And so that can necessarily breed a scenario in which women are more likely to take responsibility or to admit they're wrong if they think the interpersonal outcomes are advantageous for the person they're interacting with.
We do see a few small gender differences in humility, and I just would echo Julie's ideas, is that these are socialized and that women in our societies and the societies where we're measuring this are trained to adopt these sorts of practices, whereas men tend not to be.
Debbie, good question. Thank you. A Facebook post from Nora. Over the years, I've learned that being wrong and being able to admit it is better than staying wrong. I lose face when I cannot admit to error.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think that when you think about what there is to gain and what there is to lose, if all of a sudden that balance shifts, and by really sticking to your guts and saying, I'm not wrong in the face of overwhelming evidence that you are, then lead to people rejecting you, that's probably when a lot of people are going to say, okay, well, maybe I'm wrong, right? When the cost associated, like she's saying, losing friendships, losing face, is greater than the cost of maintaining that stance, is when we'll get people to change.
We'll go to Elizabeth, who's calling from Hollis. Hi, Elizabeth. Go ahead. You're on Main Calling.
Hi. I was I'm a retired teacher out of the Portland school system. And several years ago, we piloted a program called Theoretical Math based on the work of Davidoff. And it was one of the most important things I think I ever did in all my 42 years of teaching. And one of the parts I liked about it was affirming to all children. And children were not afraid to make mistakes. We learned from our mistakes. And we would always affirm all the answers and say, well, let's look at this. Let's see. And the children would have to prove. So the children were very brave and they would speak out, not fearing a mistake, but feeling that they would be affirmed in keeping the process going of trying to find the answer. It was based on the work of Davidoff, and it was nicknamed Russian Math. But I'm wondering if any of your people know about this, because it was wonderful. I love it. It's no longer being used, but it was great.
That's excellent. I'm not familiar with the particular math program, although my mom is a childhood educator, and I'm sure she's screaming as she's listening to this right now, telling me about it. But it does sound like the kinds of educational environments that are really helpful, this sort of process-based approach that recognizes failure and celebrates that failure and those mistakes as a part of the process. I try really hard in those educational environments, like it sounds like you did, when people make those mistakes, to recognize them and say, great, that's the first step. You would never have gotten to the second step if you didn't do that thing wrong. And that's a thing we can learn from. So having that and having it be an affirmed piece, that people feel affirmed by failing, really changes the game. And like our earlier caller, I think Cassie was talking about, doesn't attach that shame to failure, which is really important.
Elizabeth, thanks so much for your call. We're going to go to Mark in Portland. Hi, Mark. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call. I was motivated to call by hearing the listener call in with a remark about shame. And I have a long personal relationship with shame, as I think we all do. I'm a lifelong student of the teachings of yoga and Buddhism. And I have done a lot of hours in almost every state in this union, in AA programs, Al-Anon programs, recovery programs, 12-step programs. One of those steps is to make a direct admission of fault and having caused harm to people, and whenever possible, to make an apology. The teachings of Buddhism say shame can be a good thing. They talk about positive shame and negative shame. Negative shame is self-denigration, and you harm yourself. You feel guilty. Whereas positive shame is to admit that one has made an error. And that dovetails right into the topic of discussion, which is not being able to admit when we're wrong. And one of the things that Buddhism teaches is that one of the roots of our suffering is to be attached to all kinds of things, including mental things and emotional things.
Mark, thank you. That's really interesting.
Yeah, I think this connects with the piece we were talking about with the ego and separating the ego from the intellect and being able to do that, whether it's through religious practice, ritual practice, or educational practice is one of the paths to tearing this down.
An email from W.H., along with many wrongful convictions that have been revealed in recent years, it has become apparent that the criminal justice systems of many states are particularly unwilling to admit to error. The Tony Sanborn case and the Dennis DeShane case show that Maine's criminal justice system is as unwilling to consider post-conviction exculpatory evidence as that of any other state. Have there been studies about this, about the criminal, these concepts that we've been discussing in terms of the criminal justice system?
Yeah, I don't know of any offhand. That doesn't mean it doesn't exist in the criminal justice literature, which I'm obviously less familiar with. Do you know of any?
The only thing I can think of in this context would be Elizabeth Loftus's work on eyewitness memory and just finding that people, once they've made a statement in a courtroom, are very likely, even when presented with clear evidence to the contrary still sort of hold that false belief. But when it comes to more like thinking about post-conviction exculpatory evidence and those sorts of things, I don't know that literature. But I think that these kinds of processes happen both at the individual and at the group level. So if, you know, if a group, whether that be, you know, Maine, you know, justice system has made a decision, then all of the people that were sort of a part of that decision or identify as a part of that group will be bound by the same sort of psychological processes that make them reinforce the things they've done in the past.
Right. And if you think of institutions having values as well, right, if justice is a major value of our criminal justice system, then any threats to that value are going to be met with defensiveness, which is, I think, probably what we see.
Right.
Okay, I think I have time to squeeze in one more call, so I'll go to Margaret in Orland. Hi, Margaret. Go ahead.
Hi. Well, I was a graduate student and back in the late 50s at Stanford when Leon Festinger was there, and he was my one of my professors, and he was making that study about the tendency to look for corroborating evidence to your choices, and he used the term cognitive dissonance. So I see how it's grown, and I was a little concerned at the beginning that it was being popularized as though it was an embedded tendency in everybody, and it was just the way human beings work, and I thought that was a dreadful way for it to turn out. But so I'm delighted with your discussion today, where you were obviously indicating that it's a learned tendency. And I think it comes from our overemphasis on competition in our culture instead of cooperation. And, you know, if you're competing, you've got to be the best, and you don't want to admit that other people might have a useful point of view. And but now it does look like there's a little crack in that, as one of you did mention about the fact that there's a recognition of group problem solving and people being able to see that failure is part of the learning process.
Margaret, I thank you so much for your call, and I'm sorry to cut you off, but we're out of time. I want to say thank you for your call, and thank you for both of our guests today. I'll definitely have to have you both back. So interesting. That was Julie Langeua-Peterson, an associate professor of psychology and the Women's and Gender Studies Program Director at the University of New England, and Jordan LaBeouf, associate professor of psychology and honors at the University of Maine. Sandra Harris ran the board today. J.C. Cox answered your calls. You can find all sorts of information, including past editions of Maine Calling, at mainecalling.org. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and by Cindy Hahn. Also, don't forget that on tomorrow's program, we're going to be talking about murals in Maine, and we would love for you to email us photos of murals in your community. Take a picture with your smartphone and email it to us at talk@mainepublic.org. Don't forget to let us know which town that mural is in. And thanks. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.